because I don't have any PowerPoint. It's called A Universe in a Grain of Sand. And I wanted to talk about the possibility that we have some reason to think that the universe, as it were, is encoded in a grain of sand, in a small little thing traveling through space, living in space over all time. It's a...
What poet said this?
Jesus Christ, man. One sentence.
Sorry. Yes, who was it? Who was it?
I don't know. You guys have Google out there. I can't do anything. All right, so somebody please Google that in the question session.
We can discuss. It was Blake.
It's Blake and also Yates. And Keats and Kate, all of them talked about the grain of sand, but in a way different from what I want to talk about today, because that was all pre-relativistic. And in a way, not very surprising that in the pre-relativistic world, all the information about the entire universe might be encoded in a grain of sand. You know, I'm sure this has occurred to many of you in a pre-relativistic context. But in a relativistic context, it's quite surprising. So the claim is that in at least some relativistic theories, in fact a very sort of generic one, if you know what's happening in a small region of space-time, you can infer a surprising amount about what is going on in other places at other times. And if you know what's going on in that little region at all times, you can infer everything. So I will explain a little bit more about what I mean in a second, but let me just talk about the ordinary, what I want to talk about for most of this talk, but I will branch out later, is the wave equation. So I have to have a particular theory in mind to discuss its properties, and ladder. So I want to talk about the wave equation. Box psi equals zero, which most of you are familiar with. What I have to say is going to generalize to the massive wave equation. So these theories, and this, of course, is really a model for the behavior of the electromagnetic field. So what I have to say about real scalar fields also applies to the realistic case of the fields described by Maxwell's equations, because the components of the electromagnetic field follow propagate like this. So ordinarily, we know we have, this is the, I've got one dimension coming out of the board, so we're sort of envisioning 2 plus 1, two spatial dimensions in one time. We have a region of space like this, so it's coming out of the board a bit. This is a bit of a head-on view. We know that this is the data on here, it determines the field in this entire region, where these are light rays, these are null geodesics. This is a sort of a generic feature of many relativistic theories. And so what we have here is a double diamond. I would call it that anyway. So actually it's a double cone shaped like this. So field data here is determines completely the data in this whole region for this equation. Now, and furthermore, the data everywhere on the surface, this is all in Minkowski space, that's the context in which I'm discussing this. Data everywhere on the surface determines data everywhere else in the universe at all times. So that's a normal kind of way of thinking about determinism in a relativistic theory, in particular this relativistic theory. So when I was doing some work with Walter Craig a couple of years ago on the possibility of theories with multiple time dimensions, so things like we were studying the behavior of generalizations of the wave equation in spaces with more than one time. Okay, so you have a signature instead of 3 plus 1 minus, you had something like 3 plus 2 minus 3 plus 4 minus. This is an easy generalization of this kind of equation to larger spaces, spaces with more than one time. I'm not going to talk about that today in any, I don't think I'm going to talk about it at all in any details. It's just motivation. But in researching this and what had been done and what was understood about it, I came across a really interesting result in an old reference work, which many of you no doubt have on your shelves, by, it's called Methods of Mathematical Physics by Courant and Hilbert. The two-volume set. Two distinguished mathematicians, although I believe that volume two was largely written by some grad student type or postdoc. It was some underling who I think did a lot of the work in the second. I don't think even that Hilbert was even alive when the volume was published. Again, though, a Google search may yield more detail on this, and we could discuss this later. But anyways, a canonical reference work, and there was a result in there that I had never heard about, and it's really the core of what I want to talk about today. And the result is that what they're doing is they're looking at the well-posedness of theories in using initial data surfaces, such as the surface that would be like here, would be the yt plane. So here I have x, t, and then coming out of the board is y. So you might consider trying to take data on that initial surface.
Didn't you give us a talk on that before? Recently, within the last 2 years?
Well, I have no idea. That also would be available. I may have talked about that, but that's sort of peripheral to what I want to talk. It's sort of a, I'm not going to talk about that, but I probably did discuss that at some point.
I mean, maybe it was in the bar or something, but I guess I'm just asking because are you going to like shrink one of the dimensions into this talk?
I don't know. I have to figure it out. Should I shrink it to me?
Never mind.
I could shrink it. What do you guys at Western think? Shrink?
They
can't talk. I told them to turn the mic off and they're just trapped. Okay, sorry. Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'll do it. The result, so this is the context in which this result arose. They're investigating what happens if I take data not on a space-like surface, but on a surface that's mixed. I forget what they had a strange name for it, but it's a surface that's extended in space and in time. But the result, one of the results is that, see, this doesn't. The result was that data in this little region here, a spin cylinder around the time axis, determined data in that same double diamond. Okay? So this data here. Determines the same data in the same region as this data on that surface. Okay, so I drew this fairly fat, but which criterion for this is that this is a width epsilon, the extension in the spatial directions. So basically, the volume of space considered has to be finite, but can be as small as you like. It's not an infinitesimal, it's not dx, but it's as small as you like. And if you do that, if you take this data for that equation, so I'll write it over here again, just from box phi equals zero, You take the values of the field in here, they determine completely the data outside of that region. And I think this is a, well, it's not at all, it wasn't intuitive to me, and it's not intuitive to most people I've talked to. You can sort of think through a rationalization for it. In fact, you might even be able to think through a proof of it, if you think hard enough. But that's the case. I'll say a couple things about this data. Unlike data on here, on this space-like, this little piece of the space-like hypersurface, we'll call it sigma or something, this data is not freely specifiable. Okay, so this is not a well-posed problem in the sense that arbitrary data here in this cylinder doesn't correspond to a solution. All right, so if you just randomly put data down here, it's not going to be part of the solution to this equation. However, it's true that if you have a solution and you only know the solution in here, then you, in principle, know it. And this is, of course, a bit of a loaded term. You can determine it. It determines the field outside that region. So let me just pause there. Is that clear what the result is?
So if you're given the promise that you have a solution, everywhere in the region. I'm just taking.
Yeah. Well, if you have a promise,
if you have a promise that you have a solution, and somebody specifies what the solution is in this little cylinder of yours, then there's an algorithm for reconstructing the solution everywhere.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The equation actually is, and the equation is such an algorithm. I mean, it's not a, in general, going to be a super tractable problem, but the fact is that what's going on in this region, given that this determines the behavior, governs the behavior of the field of interest, what's going on in here completely determines what's going on out here. So that's for a finite cylinder, and naturally, at least in Minkowski space, if you extend this cylinder infinitely in both directions, so this may be the, if you extend this infinitely in both directions, you cover the entire space-time. Okay, so what's going on in a tiny volume determines completely what's going on everywhere else in space at all times. So I think this is an interesting kind of non-locality. It's a, well, you might not call it non-locality. It depends on, you know, we could have a long discussion, as we often do in philosophy of physics talks, about what the proper meaning of locality is. But it's a feature. It's a kind of non-locality in the sense that you have a sort of space-like determination. Certainly here, this is quite clear because this entire region The difficulty actually in making this a concrete statement is you're not talking about the relation points. You're talking about an extended region in relation to other regions. So it's not a claim about the relationship of the data here, for instance, to the data over here. There's no guarantee of any correlation here between any particular data, but it's extended. So I wanted to talk about this because I find it intriguing, and I also think it's kind of opens, it potentially opens up our thinking as to what forms non-locality can take and still be compatible with relativity. Right. You might not have thought that this sort of phenomenon was possible, but it turns out a fairly generic feature. It's a generic feature of this theory. Now, a couple of things I want to just discuss about this, possible counterexamples. One doesn't worry me, one does. So first, the one that doesn't worry me. When I first came across this result, I thought, how in the world can this be true? Right? And why was I thinking this? Because I was thinking, you're telling me that, okay, that if I'm in here, then I know everything that's going on light-wise outside here. But what happens if I have somebody out here has a laser. And they point it out, I mean, maybe they'll turn it on here, maybe it's just a laser beam directed out this way. Actually, this is not a particularly fortuitous drawing of a laser beam.
It should be at 45 degrees, I assume.
Right. Yeah, so that's why it's exactly, Lucien understands. That's why I pay Lucien actually to be here. That's a bonus. Yes, so the way to think about this, the way I drew it anyway, is to envision. In fact, I mean, you need something like this. So the laser beam, I don't know how well this is playing on camera, is kind of going into the board. It's over in this point in space, and it's directed off this way. You can think of, if you're thinking in terms of geometric optics, you think of light occupying some sort of 45-degree angle, which if we twist it around, doesn't look like that. And you can have a light beam, if you have enough dimensions, that if it's a true beam, is not going to intersect this. Which would mean, okay, that if that was the only difference, what it would mean is, if in this case, you would have no field in here. That's the proposal. That's, where's the eraser? So you really have to commit yourself here at perimeter. I forgot, because there's never
a there's one up there. I don't know if you can reach it.
One up there.
Use the hockey stick.
But I can use the hockey stick to get the eraser. That's good. The idea here is, okay, if there's nothing going on in here, what do I know? I would, you know, but from what I said, I could infer that there's nothing going on anywhere in this region. But then I introduced the possibility of having a light beam cutting through this region, never intersecting this part of this little thin cylinder. So how is that consistent with this supposed theorem? Anybody?
Even lasers diverge slightly, as they Gaussian.
Right. That's basically it. They diffract. So you can't, there is no perfect laser beam, which is, I suppose, essentially to say that the geometric optics approximation is an approximation. And the approximate nature of it is what defeats this, because this beam is going to in trying to focus it, you can focus it as much as you can try to focus it as much as you like, but it ends up, you have some diffraction off that will intersect the cylinder, and you can effectively reconstruct, well, you can't effectively reconstruct anything. You could, in principle, reconstruct the laser beam, this narrow focus beam, from the bits that intersected here.
Is there a result on precision? I mean, for instance, given the precision to which you know the fields inside the little cylinder or whatever, can you say how precisely you know them elsewhere? Because I'm thinking it's probably getting more and more sensitive as you move along.
Yeah, I bet it's extremely sensitive. So I don't know of any result.
Exponentially.
Yeah, it's basically, it's an existence, it's not an existence result, it's a uniqueness result. Hmm. That, given that equation and the data in here, this is uniquely determined. But there's nothing about, you know, stability, sensitivity to small changes. Like if you're off a little bit in here, what happens to your knowledge out
but
here?
That's really crucial. I mean, if you needed to specify to 1,000 decimal places, it would be kind of, well,
whether it's crucial or not, I'd say it depends on what purposes, if any, you want to put this to. I mean, I'm not, my claim is not that you could, there's all kinds of questions about, that you could ask about whether or not you could measure. I mean, to measure what's in here, you have to stick something in here, and then in some ways you're already disrupting the data, so there's going to be an issue about self-measurement, okay? You have some measuring device that's measuring your field to some accuracy, but now you also have the thing in there, in this region, is also going to be part of what determines what's going on out here. So I would not, I don't mean to be suggesting that this is in any way means that we have an ability to practically reconstruct this. It's really more of an ontological or a metaphysical point or than an epistemological one. To,
what? It's philosophical, it's like for all philosophical purposes.
For all philosophical purposes. How long have you been saving that up? That's fact. That's a film meant by fact. For all philosophical purposes. Brilliant. Right. I'm really, you know, I'm just the straight man in this whole thing. This is talk. All right, so that's, I mean, in thinking this through, I mean, it's useful, it's pedagogically useful because you learn something, it forces you to think through, a weird result like this forces you to think through to what extent your common assumptions about the behavior of light and things like lasers are really approximations to what extent they don't hold. All right, so, what else did I want to say about this? That's pretty much what I wanted. That was the first possible counterexample. I don't think it is a counterexample. Second worry about this is more interesting and more problematic. Not sure what to say about it, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. The other puzzle, so the suggestion here is, in the title is universe in a grain of sand. So here, I don't have just an empty field. I have a little piece of matter, and this is the world line of a finite-sized piece of matter. And then the interesting idea, especially if you, you know, anthropomorphize this and think of yourselves as that piece of matter, is that everything going on in that piece of matter over this finite time determines what's going on in this whole region. Now, even if you think about it that way, you might, one temptation, this is not the counterexample I have in mind, but one temptation might be, well, to think, well, that's crazy, because that suggests that I could cause, you know, that I could bring things about in this region. This is actually, there's an issue about this that comes up in the multiple times business about why you can't do that. But let me just say why I think that's not problematic. So even if it's the case that what's going on in a grain of sand encodes this, doesn't mean you can bring things about. Simply because what goes on in here, what's happening to this little grain of sand here, has to do also with what it's exposed to. Right? We think of ourselves as being able to control certain things. You might think of yourself, if you're have a very high opinion of yourself, as being able to completely control anything that's sort of emanating from you. I mean, I doubt that, but you might have control over the future direction, but you don't have control over what impacts you, what's coming in, or over your input. And that has just as much to do with your state, or the state of the grain of sand, as anything that comes out. So the fact that I don't think that there's any threat of superluminal causation in here, which you would be surprised if there was, because it comes out of this garden variety PDE that we're used to, and we nobody's ever thought that we could send signals faster than light if in a world governed by this equation, or in a world governed by Maxwell's equations. I don't think this gives us any reason to think that there is either. The worry that you might have, that I've been thinking about a bit, about the validity of this result, is I think this result is perfectly valid for free fields. I think it's an interesting feature of this free relativistic field theory. But when I start including matter, like a grain of sand, or more particularly charged matter, you might wonder whether this is the case. So if you think of the walls of this cylinder as made up of a perfectly conducting material, or I suppose an imperfectly conducting material, suppose then you might have a problem, because you can think of this as a Faraday cage, right? So you have a little, say, a spherical conductor, thin shell surrounding this region. So this is the region inside the thin shell. And then you wouldn't know whether or not there's, you wouldn't know what's going on out here. You could have a zero field, a null field inside this Faraday cage for this whole finite time. And that's consistent, we think, phenomenologically anyway, with there being obviously zero field out here. It's also consistent with there being any static electric field of any kind, or of any magnitude, I should say, any magnitude and direction. There's only so many kinds of static electric fields. They're pretty qualitatively uninteresting physical constructions. Right, so the idea behind the Faraday cage is, well, it's just a shielded cage, is that if you apply an electric field, the charges in the wall of the conductor, if you need a conductor, will rearrange themselves in such a way as to cancel the field on the interior of the object. So, what does that mean for this this result? It might mean that we actually have evidence that we have a classical relativistic theory which doesn't have this feature, this weird domain of dependence. So, in other words, you might want to conclude that Maxwell theory coupled to a complex Klein-Gordon field to represent the charged matter, or Dirac field, or maybe a set of discrete charged particles, is another example of a relativistic theory, but one which doesn't display this strange non-local behavior. So you have, the idea is that you would have ordinary determinism of the timeline kind, where you can take the charge distribution and the field values on this initial piece of space, and then evolve it forward and backward in time and find that it determines this. But that maybe that would fail for the time-like cylinder. So that's one possibility. And what reasons in its favor is that, you know, we can build things that are at least approximate Faraday cages. Well, that must be the case. On the other hand, it's not at all clear, to me anyway, that you can really build a Faraday cage out of a Dirac field or a bunch of charged point particles. Now, what I'm not talking about here, I don't mean to be introducing the general problem of whether or not there is a consistent theory of the electromagnetic field coupled to charged matter. There's a debate about this, about whether it's mathematically well-defined or whether it can be. Matthias Frisch wrote a really interesting book about this a couple of years ago, and has been back and forth about it. But on the other hand, there are proposals, purely field-theoretic proposals, some having to do with particles. The work of Michael Kiesling deals with this, and there's a guy named Herbert Spohn in Germany who's spent a lot of time trying to give a well-defined, consistent theory of charges coupled to the electromagnetic field. So I'm supposing, you know, given that even if we have such a theory, and I think maybe you can make it work, the existence of something like a spherical shell of matter is probably ultimately dependent on quantum theory. In other words, it's very difficult to build a theory of stable matter that retains its shape and structure in any sort of classical model of the charges. right? They won't, you know, charges tend to, they'll either explode or collapse. I mean, you see this in gravity as well. How do you get stable matter? So one of the great victories of quantum mechanics, it's pretty puzzling. The interpretation is a complete mystery as far as I'm concerned. But it does explain many things, and among them it explains why we can have stable atoms from which we can build things like Faraday cages. All right, so I don't really know what to make of what you might call the Faraday cage counterexample. What does it show?
Might you just be as suspicious of it as you were of ray optics,
right,
in your first example?
Mm-hmm.
So, just as you don't have, you know, light without any diffraction, maybe you don't really have perfect Faraday cage. That might just invalidate your example right there.
Right. Yes, so this occurs.
At least I've never seen a perfect Faraday cage.
Have you looked?
No, but I've been in one before. and
it was all leaky. So a couple more words about this. Yes, you might think about this. So let me say two things about the perfect Faraday cage example. One is the real difficulty I did. There are clear difficulties in building a so-called Faraday cage that blocks all radiation.
It was called the National Security Agency. I was serious. I have been in a Faraday cage before. I've been in the National Security Agency.
The official Faraday cage?
And I know it's leaky because the Russians have listened in from time to time. Go on.
Okay. I don't know what to make of that. Did you all hear that out in London, Ontario? That's good. Right. There's plenty of good reasons to think that the example of the Faraday cage is not of huge interest if all you're thinking of doing is screening off radiation. It's difficult to, I think especially high frequency radiation, I don't know that it is, I think it's extremely difficult to build a Faraday cage that doesn't admit that leaves that out. Now, static fields are a different beast. And you might say, well, I don't really care about static fields. They're not very interesting. They don't tell me much about what's going on in the universe anyway. So maybe your result holds modulo static fields. In other words, okay, I can see that there might be a theory in which I don't know, there's no evidence inside this region, if it's surrounded by a conductor, of whether or not there's a static electric field outside. But I can know everything dynamical. I can know all about the light, the radiation, the radio waves from whatever signature they leave inside here. That's a more moderate position. It's less extreme, but I think that would still be interesting if that were true. I don't know if it's true. I think it's going to be, whether it's true is going to depend completely on exactly how you model the interacting matter. Right? You know, what is it? Is it some sort of charged fluid? Is it a bunch of point particles interacting in a certain way? Is it a field? Is it a fundamental field like a Klein-Gordon field? It's going to depend. It's going to be hard to answer. On the other hand, once you get to that point, you might think, well, what I care about is not so much the theory. I care about the world, which, of course, we only know through a theory. And ultimately, my theory is going to be quantum mechanical or something successor to quantum mechanics. So what I really want to know is there some sense in which in the theory that does successfully model stable matter, that we have this kind of non-locality, that the information within, you know, a region of this type determines the physical facts in the region outside. Now, the question here is going to be, depending on what the theory is, what its notion of the physical facts is going to differ. So I think this is interesting for people thinking about non-locality, non-local theories which are intended to model quantum correlations and quantum quantum behavior. It's a kind of causally benign non-locality, which is nonetheless fairly intriguing. And it does raise the possibility, even outside of quantum theory, that somehow that you can, that this particular a restricted region of space-time is encodes in some ways the entirety of the whole universe. One more thing I will say before I stop, and then I want to open this up to questions and comments. I welcome comments. Is this whole issue of the Faraday cage is one which is doesn't really, there is no analogous model that I know of in general relativity. So you could ask these questions for general relativity. It's very difficult or, well, more or less impossible to shield things from gravity in the way that you can shield them from gravitational fields, in the way that you can shield them from electric fields. So if you wanted to, you could look at just the vacuum field equations of general relativity and ask about this behavior or these properties. I say just, but those are highly non-trivial, and this has the advantage of being a linear theory, much easier to study than something like general relativity. But we could ask the question there. All right, let me stop and throw this open to discussion. Thanks. How far away are you, anyway? How do we do this?
You can field your own questions.
But do I like point at the monitor, or do I use
the oxygen? You're kind of just, can you see them?
I can see them. Get out of my yard! Questions, anywhere? Anyone? Western? No, okay. Lucid.
So if this was to be applied to quantum theory, then you're thinking of something like hidden variable, because this is deterministic. So you think it's like a hidden variable, a deterministic hidden variable version of quantum theory. So the only example we have of such a thing, well, probably many examples, the only example I know of such a thing is the Broglie-Bohm model, which
right.
is really sort of pathologically non-local in a different sense.
Right.
Even without this question. So do you think this question is interesting in the context of that theory? And that theory isn't at the hidden variable level of the rates and variables.
Right. No, yeah, I don't think it was. I thought about that. I don't think it's interesting for Bohm theory. The way I was thinking about this is possibly being manifesting itself in the context of quantum theory is I wondered about the role of the vector potential, conceiving of the vector potential as a local variable, as you do in the Aharonov-Bohm effect, and then having correlation. So actually, I've kind of wondered, I have not thought this through, about whether or not, if I have an external electric field here, whether that is going to affect, and I'm trying to write the electric field down in terms of a scalar potential or a scalar and combination scalar and vector potential, whether that will affect the or constrain the field, the potential, the choice of the potential in the cylinder. So that's one way sort of to think about a kind of non-locality that comes up in quantum mechanics with, you know, interestingly, with the interaction of charged particles with electromagnetic fields. Here. But I'm open to, I think this is a... No, No, and I explicitly disassociated it from any claims about signaling and causality and perturbation. The claim is just that it's a claim about determinism. Given if you have a solution and let me rephrase that. Given data in this cylinder, this thin cylinder, which is compatible with the solution is uniquely determined in this region, in the double cone region. That's the claim. Yeah, if the perturbation was also compatible with a solution. I mean, what you don't have is you don't have the ability to freely choose initial data in this cylinder. So arbitrary initial, an arbitrary scalar field given in this cylinder will not correspond to a global solution of that equation. So you could start with something, you could start with a vacuum. Yeah, you get the point? That's the claim. This result, if you're interested, is sort of the end of volume two of Methods of Mathematical Physics. And there's a related, and in some ways more interesting result to Holmgren, which is in, and kind of cleaned up by Fritz John in Fritz John's, I think the fourth edition of his textbook, Partial Differential Equations. Something like this is actually a homework problem in somebody's PDE textbook.
Nice.
Yeah.
Is it difficult to see why it's true? No, there's not some simple intuition you can give us.
No.
Okay.
It's easier to see why. It's easier to see why this whole. Why you have a kind of determinism when you have a kind of a mixed surface, a mixed hypersurface of the time-like and space-like, and you're trying to evolve this way or this way. That's a little easier. You can almost just look at the equation and think, well, I have enough variables. I mean, I have some, you know, I have four unknowns. I've got three of them. That's a little oversimplifying a little bit. And I can just solve for the other one, right? Because I just have a bunch of derivatives going in this direction, you know, time derivatives and spatial derivatives. And off you go. As I say, the main difference, and this is also interesting, between these, not just, this thin cylinder problem is in sort of a different form. The difference between the problem on a mixed surface, like a space-time surface, and a purely space-like surface has to do with the well-posedness. Although, this is something that that Walter, Craig, and I resolve by imposing a constraint on the data imposed on a space-time surface. In other words, you can get around with it, but without it, in the absence of a constraint, you can freely give data on a spatial surface, but you can't freely give data on a space-time surface and hope that it will correspond to a solution.
Is the constraint sort of like a local constraint?
No, it's not local, but it can be quasi-local. I mean, it's... You can't completely, the constraint is basically given in terms of the wave number, I suppose, so it's done in momentum space. As a simple form of momentum space, it has a completely, you know, obscure form in position space. So it is a kind of non-local constraint. Although there's some indication that you can, that if you have data on here, you can't freely, specify it, but you can have fairly well localized data. Okay, so in other words, if you're considering this surface, clearly nothing on the surface corresponds to a solution, the vacuum solution, and you could put data on the surface which drops off exponentially. So you can consider a little bit of data here which kind of tapers away exponentially as you get further away on the surface, and that will also count. So that's a kind of local data, but it's not completely local. We can't go to zero in any finite region of that surface. Yeah.
Maybe it'd be nice to see if, or hear a discussion between you and Chris Mink and anybody else who knows about the history of general relativity. I don't know who all this in this audience. But imagine it's 1914 or 1915, and Einstein has just sewed up his whole argument. He's got that straight in his mind. And now he turns his attention to something like this, where we have the vacuum Einstein equations, and he says, oh, I'm promised a solution, I have a solution. And now I cut out a little cylinder and throw the rest of it away. Mm-hmm. And suppose it were the case that you couldn't reconstruct the field out in your cone. Mm-hmm. Would he be troubled by that? See, I'm guessing you probably can reconstruct outside. But
in general,
but I don't know. But suppose you can't.
Right.
Would Einstein have been troubled by that?
Chris, would Einstein have been troubled by that? Other. See, every minute of my talks, as my students know, is very filled with crucial information. This is just a demonstration of it. Nothing wasted. Right, well, I mean, yeah, I think adding matter to this does complicate the situation.
Leave it,
and that's the sort of where the Machian thing comes in. So, just Chris's point, I suppose, is that, okay, if you know, I'm not sure actually why whether Einstein's supposed to be bothered or not.
I'm curious.
But the idea is, okay, just consider...
Maybe another way of asking the same question is there any connection whatsoever between the sort of consideration here
and the whole part?
And the sorts of consideration.
Right. The idea is that this is playing a role in the whole. Is that right?
So in the whole, we've got... So we start off with a solution. And now we cut out a little hole, and we ask whether
we have
everything on the outside redetermines everything on the inside. Mm-hmm. And here we're saying reconstruct everything on the outside from what's on the inside of this little hole.
Right, it's the converse. Right.
It's converse.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They're definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, the close analog of the whole argument here is if you just wrote everything down in terms of the vector potential for electromagnetic field, and you didn't use you weren't using the E field, the B field, you're using some, four vector A, and then you would find that obviously that there would be. Actually, not obviously, but there's probably different choices of vector potential in here that are consistent with a choice out here. But I don't think that's... Chris, you had something. You're sort of fishing at something for something else, and I'm trying to get a better sense. So the idea is that he had some concerns about locality, which were threatened, or determinism, actually, which were threatened by the whole argument, which he eventually convinced himself and were not legitimate concerns. And then the question is, would he have some sort of similar concerns about this feature if this were a feature of general relativity. So let's get inside the minds of Einstein here. Come on, just for a minute.
This equation presumably would have the same the field equations had because that was invariant in the diffeomorphisms. And so that was why there wasn't a unique solution.
Right.
Whereas here, there is it. Now, I'm assuming that actually you made that all work. Assuming that the data on the surface of the cylinder actually also shows what's inside the cylinder. Is that right?
The data on the surface, the data out here?
No, no, just the data on the surface.
The surface of the cylinder, whether it would determine the...
What's the inside, the field inside. I'd be very surprised if that wasn't the case, because the equations are continuous across the boundary.
It has to be a mistake in the last one.
All right, well, so...
You
don't want that.
Continuous across the boundary. Well, it could be...
I'm just trying to make it more analogous to the whole situation.
I doubt it. I don't think that the surface of the cylinder has enough information on it.
Just tell me what's inside.
Well, the surface is a two-dimensional object. This is a three,
is actually the
whole that means epsilon. It's not a...
It's not just on the surface. It's on the whole of the... Okay.
It's in this region, which can be as small as you like, but it's still a finite-sized spatial region.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you did say that, but I find that surprising. My intuition runs like Lucian's, that if you knew the data on the surface of the cylinder, it would determine...
Right. Well, one of the things that comes up in these kinds of problems, which we encountered in our paper on multiple times, in different sorts of initial value problems, is which data? Like, do you know the field and its first time derivative, or its first derivative in the normal direction, or do you have all... This is what Chris was talking about, I guess, to all orders. Do you have all the derivatives of the field?
Yeah.
And... is that sufficient? So these are, and you can ask for any, if I'm given any finite number of derivatives, or if I'm given, infinite number of derivatives.
Fair enough. So knowing the field on the cylinder and say its first derivative is a little bit like dipping into the interior of the cylinder. I mean, how else would you know the derivative unless you knew how it was changing?
Right, but there's more information that you could extract if you took more derivatives about the interior of the cylinder. Then the question is, can you get enough?
Right.
But what you can't do, I'm pretty sure, I don't think, so another related question is, if you just took the data on T, if you took the value of the field on T and you took, I'm almost positive that if you take any finite number of derivatives, of the data on T, so you have to, so this is this phi, and then this d phi dx, and then d second derivative, etc. That's not enough. The other thing I will mention too here is that may have occurred to some of you who are, silently scoffing at this, that this is nothing to do with analytic data. These are not, sometimes in PDEs, you have studies of PDEs with solutions that are analytic. This is completely, they have to be, I don't actually remember the differential requirement, but this is not analytic data. This is not the idea that, I've given an analytic function in some little region of it, I can tell you what the values of the function elsewhere. And I will read, it's kind of fun to see the comment that, I guess it's Courant that actually wrote this. We're dealing with the remarkable phenomenon of functions which are not necessarily analytic, yet whose values in an arbitrarily small region determine the function in a substantially bigger domain.
So one little thing is true.
Yeah.
This is true. Is let's take a cylinder with a thick wall, a hole down the middle, and I have the data inside the wall.
Okay, so there's a finite wall. This is what we're
finite thickness wall, and I have the data throughout the wall, but not inside the cylinder.
Okay.
Then, as long as the wall has epsilon thickness, I will determine the data everywhere. Because
yeah,
I could just take a cylinder.
Well, because that is a cylinder. The wall itself is a cylinder.
I could take a cylinder which is inside the wall, and that would of course do it. So
right.
So then I do have a hole. I want.
You have a hole if you want.
Yeah, inside the cylinder I just described it as a hole.
Right.
So you kind of ask the whole question.
But of course, that was the original, I take it that is the original sort of way in which the whole argument was posed, until the idea, the notion of gauge freedom was clarified. But yeah, this has nothing to do with, I mean, there isn't any gauge freedom in this scalar field. Well, we haven't, I suppose you could define some, but there's no constraint, there's no, it's not a gauge theory.
Right.
It's a feature of hyperbolic linear equations that have, that can be put into this form. So you can put the massive wave equation into this form by a change of variables. But, you know, an interacting field theory that is, well, it's a different sort of beast. And whether it has these properties or not is hard to say.
Does it depend on the dimension of the space? Is it true for any dimension?
Yes.
True for any dimension.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, the study that we started with, because we were studying multiple times, I mean, it was just n space and m time dimensions. So, yeah, nothing to do with so, if you took well, yeah, let me know. I'm not going to go into this result. So I have a couple papers on this. Anybody who wants the references to the multiple time stuff, just feel free to talk to me or email me and I can send you the papers. But I think it's going to, that will take us a little far afield. But yeah, this is not dimension specific. That can be anything. But I thought it'd be interesting to talk about the ordinary 3+1 case because that's the one that we think is the best candidate, unless we're string theorists. Any string theorists sneak in here? God, all right. That's the one we think is real. Doreen?
So, yeah, following up on your last comment about interacting field theories.
Yeah.
Is the thought behind your second counterexample, the mm-hmm. one you think is worrying, right? Not the laser one, but the
Faraday
cage one.
Yeah.
That suggests that you're not going to be able to derive the analogous mathematical result for the interacting case. Right, because you could go. I guess you could go about it in two ways, right? You can try and tackle. I assume the math is going to be really hard.
Yes.
In the interacting field case, right? So it's going to be hard to see whether you could derive the analogous result for the two.
Well, I would just say one thing. I mean, there is part of the problem is there isn't the interacting field case. There's many. You know, you'd have to figure out how am I going, which interacting
okay.
field theory is going to be my model of electromagnetism.
Right, okay.
Is it particles, is it classical fields, and which kind of classical fields? So
you're going to need some consistent interacting formalism in which to even pose the question. But that's the question you want to set aside, right?
I thought I would set that aside for now, yes.
Okay.
But I think, yeah, if you wanted to know about properties of particular theories, I've seen one of the things I think that's interesting when you start thinking about this, to me anyway, that comes out is, am I interested in the determinism of a particular mathematical formalism, of a particular mathematical representation of the world, whether that's deterministic in this way or the other way, in the normal, you know, Cauchy surface way, or in this strange time-like cylinder way, or is my question about determinism one about the world? You know, is the world in some sense deterministic, and if so, how? I mean, and we see this in quantum, a lot of people in quantum foundations here, so in, you know, ordinary quantum mechanics, the world is not deterministic. In Bohm theory, it is deterministic. So to some extent, this is a question that's not, you can't settle without committing yourself to some theory or other. But I think you can get a kind of a, if you're looking to figure out what theory that, what you're, if you're looking at phenomena and you're wondering about what theory models the world, what can model the world, this is just interesting in that it's conceivable that you could model, so here's like a more radical claim, some kinds of non-local phenomena, maybe some subset of quantum phenomena using this kind of non-locality. Okay, the non-locality which is really already there in a regular local classical theory. I'm not saying that you can reproduce, you know, the EPR correlations doing this, but maybe it accounts for something. But I cut you off in the middle, Dorney. I mean, was there...
No, that was, yeah. I was just wondering how... Because it seems like, yeah, it does seem like there's two ways you can go, right? You can go the really formal mathematical route.
Right.
Get the interacting version of that
yeah.
for electromagnetism, and then try and prove the analogous result.
Yeah.
Or else, but that might not give you what you want because that allows...
Yeah, you might at the end of the day, you finish that, you show that this holds for an interacting, you know, Dirac field and Maxwell field, and that's great, but then you decide that you don't really think that your matter in the actual world is well modeled by a Dirac field, that somehow a classical Dirac field just is not going to do the trick.
And then, which is sort of happening in the laser case, right?
Well, the laser case, I feel, is just sort of the failure of an approximation, and you're sort of thinking in terms of, right, which you could think of there, but it could be that a Dirac field is not even an interesting approximation of classical matter.
Okay.
It's just that the quantized Dirac field has the relevant properties, but the classical one doesn't. I'm just throwing that out there. I would say, though, that mathematically, it's hard, but it's not as hard as it might be, because a lot of what you see in the mathematical work on interacting PDEs is attempts to show things like well-posedness. So you're trying not to show only, I mean, that's been an open question until recently. I think Kleinerman, about 10 years ago, did some really important work on, I think it's the Maxwell-Klein-Gordon system, showing that it was well-posed for for any finite energy initial data. So you probably want some, you know, initial data that kind of goes off to zero in some finite region. It's sort of like asymptotically flat. But there you have to show not only the existence and uniqueness of a solution, but you have to talk about stability. Here, the only concern is showing that there is, that given a solution, there's a unique extension. Depending on the tools available, that can be a much more tractable problem than the full demonstration of, you know, of stability. And then, and at the same time, there's no claim of existence for arbitrary data in here. Right. I will also add that if you haven't studied this stuff, it can be, especially, I mean, addressing this to students, a little confusing. This talk about well-posedness. The Courant and Hilbert is one of the places where this kind of talk really started to get a foothold. It was suggested by Hadamard. Well-posedness has their three criteria: is existence, uniqueness, and stability. What those mean is discussed in there, but at two different points in that two-volume set, two very different attitudes about or toward the criterion of well-posedness are taken. It's almost as if the book was written by more than one person. It's pretty interesting. At one point, you know, the perspective is, well, the only physically interesting solutions are, or equations, physical laws are ones which have a well-posed initial value formulation. And then the other part is kind of scoffing at that as being incredibly narrow-minded. And this other perspective adopts the position that this is an interesting subset, the well-posed subset. So that's something that might be interesting for somebody to dig into. But I mention it because it's coming up, and we're only discussing, when we're talking about determinism in this context, we're only talking about one of the components of what's called the well-posed problem. We're only talking about unique extensions of this data into other regions, which is to say we're talking about the question of whether this determines this. And once again, you know, I would say that the one of the more interesting features of this is if you consider the entire universe to be represented by Minkowski space, and the universe is eternal and not expanding nor contracting, then you have this kind of encoding of the entire universe in one finite region. Extending this to a situation, the easiest way to sort of, one thing you might try to do is to sort of, okay, well, what happens if the universe is a finite initial singularity, a space-like singularity? What then? Now, you could model that if the universe is flat. If you want to go and model the universe as Friedman, Roberts, and Walker, then you might have another question on your hands, but possibly tractable ones. In other words, You have a Robertson Walker universe with the matter described by a scalar field like this. The universe is only finite in time. How much of the universe can you reconstruct from one of these time-like cylinders, which originates at the initial singularity and goes infinitely into the future? How much of the universe can you get? And how much does that depend on the particular model? That would be an interesting question, which I haven't addressed, but I think it's possibly tractable. Anything else? Anybody else that...
If the universe were really like this, you'd wonder why God would even bother with giving you anything but the cylinder, wouldn't you?
Right. It's because we're finite beings, and we're flawed, and we need everything spelled out for us, you know, numerous...
Oh, I see. He gives us a little redundancy. So.
Yeah, we need redundancy, because we're the kind of people that things that we are. I think there's probably an anthropic going on here in some places.
Wouldn't we be part of the cylinder?
Right, but it's our limits on self-knowledge, right? Which are limited. It's limited because of the bit of the Genesis about eating from the tree of the knowledge of knowledge of good and evil. That's the kind of the original limitative result. Okay, we're banished from heaven. No one. Okay, I'm not going to expand on this anymore. I'm going to contract on it. Forget it ever happened.
It's going to be recorded on first. It's too late.
It's on first, right? We can edit. Okay. We can hack. Anything else? Anyone else? Students? Dumb questions, which are actually not dumb. Faculty, smart-seeming questions, which actually are dumb.
I'm one of those.
Yeah.
What about Meneghel's interpretation? So the Schrodinger equation isn't quite that form, but it's essentially a kind of form.
Oh yeah, the Schrodinger equation looks like the heat equation.
And you've got many. That would be one of the higher dimensional cases because it's in configuration space. So does it? I mean, because since it's in configuration space, it's kind of non-local anyway. So does this, what is
right, but what would there be?
What does this mean in that context?
Yeah. So what? Yeah, the Schrodinger equation would add like that, right?
Okay.
It's two spatial derivatives, and then one time derivative of the field on the right. That's
right. Yeah. There's all bunch.
Because this is H.
And now thinking of to make it interesting for my world, you have many particles, so there are many axes.
Right. But this is why you're asking about the dimension, whether it's limited. Right, but yeah, you can have as many spatial dimensions as you want.
Okay.
So
you can apply it to the many worlds module of this point about the time.
DT, yeah. Oh. And I don't know if you could absorb that DT into a redefinition. Probably not, but... Yeah, I bet you can. I mean, because the Schrodinger equation, as far as... And this is an interesting line. So if you guys... I don't know if you got... Guys, can you guys hear Lucien's questions or Chris's and whoever? You can. Okay. All right. So the question had to do with whether or not this would apply, something like this would apply to the Schrodinger equation. But the Schrodinger equation is interestingly different, I know, at least in the sense of, in the ordinary sense, because the Schrodinger equation is like the heat equation, isn't it? But isn't that what the heat equation looks like?
It's a complex number.
Right.
Other than I, it's the heat equation.
Yeah. And the heat equation, the ordinary initial value problem is not well posed. Well, it's well posed in one time direction, but not the other. Which isn't to say that there isn't any sort of analogous or similar result that you could get from the Schrodinger equation. It's just that I don't think it's going to carry across neatly. I'm not positive. Anybody else have any thoughts on that? I'd love to hear. Okay. Post it in the comments section on PERSA, which is coming soon.
All right, let's thank Steve again.
Thanks for coming.